In a packed Paris metro car at the counter of a bustling cafe, it's easy in 2025 to forget about what was about to hit us 5 years ago. But on this, the fifth anniversary of the first COVID lockdown in China, what's grabbing headlines is the backlash. Donald Trump on day one signing the order for the United States to quit the World Health Organization. We'll ask why the UN body could lose its biggest donor and about the grievances against leaders in global health policy. Are we talking about fringe anti-vaxxers or a deeper malaise? And just as many who fell ill in those first days and weeks of the pandemic still suffer from long COVID, did the fear, loneliness, anxiety many felt under lockdown continue to impact our politics today? What is it that we haven't fully processed 5 years on? Today in the France 24 debate, we're looking at COVID, the backlash. With us from Oxford, England, she's formerly worked with several UN agencies, Dr. Moga Kamal Yani, Senior Global Health Policy Advisor to the People's Medicine Alliance. Thank you for being with us. From Washington, Michael Cannon, Director of Health Policy Studies at the Cato Institute Think Tank. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And with us as well is France 24 Washington correspondent Fraser Jackson. Good to see you.
Good to be with you.
By the way, if you want to take the time to listen to the show in its entirety, well, you can always do that and subscribe and like the France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. The date was January the 22nd, 2020. That was the first time that we on this show devoted an entire episode to the coronavirus pandemic. Yes, that's a younger version of me you see there. Back then, our concern was the first cases and all the travel surrounding Chinese New Year. The rest that would follow is, as they say, history. Wuhan and China, where it all began, would endure years of strict lockdown. Everybody there still remembers.
I think people in Wuhan are moving forward. These memories are getting fuzzier and fuzzier, but they still have an impact on us. It feels like those years were particularly tough. That's the impression you get. But a new life has started anyway.
It took me more than a year after the lockdown to feel like we were slowly returning to normal. After they fully relaxed the COVID restrictions in 2022, that was when I felt that everyone had opened up and had almost returned to how things were before the pandemic.
Moga Kamal Yani, your reaction listening to those young people in Wuhan? We seem to have an issue with the sound. We are unfortunately going to try to fix that right away. Apologies for that. We'll cross back live to you. Fraser Jackson, first off, where were you 5 years ago today?
This whole saga, it kind of feels like a distant fever dream already, but I was at the office in France 24. I remember actually going on break for Christmas 2019. And I remember seeing that first alert coming through about some infections that had happened in this small town, or obviously a large city, as we then found out, in China that I'd never heard of. I remember thinking, oh, that's interesting. And then you fast forward a month and obviously things kind of accelerated at a breakneck speed. And I remember being there in Paris when it started to get serious. I actually had a friend who was working inside of the health ministry in Paris. And when we were told that we were going to go on lockdown, this friend told me that it was going to be announced that this lockdown was going to happen, and it would be announced that it would only be for a couple of weeks, but that it would actually be closer to 6 weeks, but they didn't want to announce everything straight away. So I messaged a friend who was living alone at the time, and I was as well, and she said, why don't we live together so at least we're not on our own? And I ended up thinking that I would live there for 6 weeks, and I was there for 2.5 years. So it kind of took everybody's life by surprise, even people who are more in the know than others, as it were.
Moga Kamal Yani, I think we've fixed the audio issues. Can you hear us okay?
I can hear you okay. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear. You're on a university campus right now, and a campus town, at least, Oxford. again, when you heard those young people say how the memory of COVID is beginning to get fuzzier, your reaction?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I do remember the days of COVID clearly. In fact, I do remember in December 23, later in December, when I read about a strange disease affecting people in China. It didn't have a name at that time. And then beginning of January, they were starting to talk about it. I knew that it's going to be a big deal. I didn't, of course, imagine lockdown and all that, but I knew it was going to be a big deal. And one thing that we tend to forget, that on the 10th of January, the Chinese actually put the genetic code of the virus online, on the internet. So it was publicly available. And that was the time that you say that I'm in Oxford University town. I'm not in the university, but in the town. Oxford University scientists started to work on what is now called AstraZeneca vaccine. It's actually Oxford University vaccine. They started immediately, and that was because the genetic code was open to public. And I do remember that. At the beginning here in England, they took it seriously. It appeared some people had it in a little town in the south. And then suddenly they kind of ignored it, and the government prime minister went on holiday and all that. And then it was, you know, it spread all over the place. So they had to do a lockdown. But I just have to say that... you mentioned WHO at the beginning and Dr. Tedros. WHO didn't say lockdown, by the way. They didn't advise to lockdown.
Yeah, that was at the very beginning. Michael Cannon, it's true that I remember when China shared the genetic code for this coronavirus, people thought this would be a great moment of international cooperation. And as it turned out, it kind of turned into a mixed bag because it was competition at the beginning. Everybody was in a bit of a panic to get face masks. There was competition. So how to get the coronavirus vaccine out as quickly as possible. And it was rolled out in record time. Overall, when you look back for global health, was this a win or a lose?
Well, it was a win to science.
Let me ask Michael Cannon. Go ahead.
There were successes and failures in fighting COVID-19. There were successes in that we identified the genetic code quickly. China did not release it, though, as quickly as it could have. Scientists developed vaccines and diagnostic tests very quickly, but public health officials bottled up both of those things. We could have done a lot better fighting COVID-19. And as a reaction to their own failures, policymakers then went far overboard with lockdowns and other measures designed to hopefully contain the virus. It's not clear how much those worked, but they were an effort to make up for the very severe failures that we saw from the World Health Organization, from the CDC in the United States, from the Food and Drug Administration in the United States, and other agencies around the world.
There was a lot of criticism, we remember, of Boris Johnson, who took too long to lock down. There's questions over how many people died because of that.
Well, I think
that is certainly the case. But when you asked what were we doing at this time 5 years ago, I remember that I was just weeks away from my wife's office closing, my office closing, and all three of my very young children's schools closing for an entire year. I can envision scenarios where lockdowns can make sense, where they could be morally permissible for the government to do that. I don't think that was permissible for, if at all, during the COVID-19 pandemic, for very long, certainly not for as long as it was. What it was an overreaction to the failures that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration put in the way of combating this disease by slowing the testing and rollout of vaccines as well as diagnostic tests. Remember, the Food and Drug Administration approved for weeks and months only one diagnostic test for COVID-19, and it was the one developed by the U.S. government, the Centers for Disease Control, and it was a faulty test. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization had approved other vaccines that other countries around the world were using, South Korea to great effect. But there were serious failures, and when we cannot look at lockdowns in a vacuum and say, oh, well, this is the disease, we have to lock down because of the disease. It's also because of public health failures.
Charlotte Marchandise, director of the European Public Health Association, joins our conversation now. Welcome to the France 24 debate. What's your memory when you think in terms of global health policy as to how the world fared 5 years ago and in the months and years that followed?
Hi, nice to see you all. Well, 5 years ago, I was not in this position. In UFA, I was a deputy mayor for health in Rennes, in France, and I was head of WHO Healthy City. So I was working closely with WHO. I was working not that closely to government, and we were trying not only to understand what was happening, but to understand the answer of our government to what was happening. And we all knew something like that would happen in public health. I mean, pandemic crisis has always been our fear. What we were trying to do is actually to fight disinformation, misinformation, and also try to tell people how science is created, that we don't have an answer. And what we've seen and what we've been publishing with UFA now is that the government that actually were more listening to the people and more explaining, like, okay, there are things we don't know, but this is how we are going to build answer. We're actually the one that had better answers because they were attentive to people and they didn't lie to their population. So 5 years ago, I was really trying to build trust and tell people why decisions and why decisions were so hard to make as a government.
And what was it? Name some of those governments you said that were more forthcoming in what they knew and what they didn't know?
Well, for instance, the example of New Zealand, the Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, she's been proven to be build a lot of trust to her population. She was Skyping with them, and she didn't pretend to be a scientist, but she pretended to be the bridge in between science, in between government, and in between population. And she did that in a way that built trust. There are several other examples that are actually a good outcome. Then it's kind of easy to see it afterwards and not see it. And everyone tried to make good decisions. What we really know is everything that was public health system, public health function, public health worker, and the way we could communicate with community is actually what was helping. And this is what we should be preparing now.
All right. And the impact, again, we mentioned it at the outset. What is the impact today? In the United States, public surveys compiled by the website Statista show that the mental health toll from lockdown, that lockdown, and you heard Michael Cannon saying for him it lasted for too long in many places and for many schools. Well, that mental health toll is fading if you look at this graph. But what you see in yellow here is 2019. What you see in purple is 2024. It's come down, but there are still a lot of people suffering from anxiety or depression that remain well above pre-pandemic equivalents. Moga Kamalyani, the lingering effect on mental health from COVID, how do you gauge it and how real is it?
Well, I mean, it is real, but it's not the effect on just lockdown. I mean, colleague was saying, you know, look at the lockdown in the context of everything else, of the public health situation, and also of COVID itself. I mean, COVID itself, I mean, one of the big symptoms of long COVID is mental vagueness, is depression and anxiety, all these symptoms. So COVID itself causes these issues as well as the fear, the worry that what will happen next. It's not just a lockdown. I think lockdown affected certain sections of the population more than others. For example, you talked about children missing schools, but also, you know, not just children as one block of children. Children with some disabilities or children with special needs, particularly children with learning difficulties, they miss the routine of going to school at a certain time and having to study at a certain time, and then everything else after, going to grandparents or relatives or whatever. So it affected people, different population differently. And as I say, it's not just the lockdown that affected people. And of course, we have now long COVID. I mean, if the majority of people forgot about COVID, people who have long COVID haven't forgotten it, and they're still suffering. I have close friends who are still having long COVID, 3-4 years afterwards.
Michael Cannon, during lockdown, it was a moment where those who perhaps had a frenetic pace to their lives, stay away from the office. It wasn't the case for a lot of blue-collar jobs, but those who could, were forced to stay in place. We're always on the go. And it was, pictures of people baking sourdough bread on their social media feeds and this kind of thing. But it was also a change in the way we work from home, for instance. We heard on Monday the U.S. president order all federal workers back to their offices full time. Is that chapter over for good, this sort of trying to get a balance between being in the office and working remotely?
No one knows what the new equilibrium will be when it comes to in-person work versus remote work. That part of COVID is actually kind of exciting to see how it changes the nature of work in the labor market. But one thing we can be sure about is that one of the reasons that the lockdowns happened too frequently and went on too long is because the people who were making those decisions were largely people who had the disposable income and the type of jobs where they could stay at home and do their work from home, where not everybody had that luxury. So others, they were making decisions that affected other people's incomes. And this is a really important point. It was anger over the lockdowns and other excessive public non-pharmaceutical interventions to stop the spread of COVID-19 that led to so much resentment against public health officials that now there's a loss of trust in public health officials. There has been a huge drop in the number of Republicans in the United States who think that vaccines are important. There's been a huge increase in the number of Republicans in the United States who think that vaccines are worse than the diseases they fight. That isn't just because of vaccine skeptics like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and others who've been spreading falsehoods about relationships between, say, autism and vaccines that just don't exist. It's also because the public health officials who were in charge during COVID-19 forgot maybe the most basic fundamental rule of public health, which is you have to keep the trust of the public. If you lose that trust, then everything else that you do is going to be at least less meaningful, less successful, because no one's going to listen to the advice you're giving them if they feel like that you don't have their best interest at heart.
And so you had Donald Trump, who was voted out of office after having the lockdowns on his watch, and now has been voted back in. That loss of trust, is it just that incumbents are always going to get voted out?
I'm sure that had a factor both in Donald Trump's played a role both in Donald Trump's loss in 2020 and his victory in 2024, but it is having a much longer term, I'm afraid, impact on public trust in public health officials. You saw a backlash at the state level in many states, where states took away public health powers from public health authorities. That was a bit of a misfire, actually, because most of the problems came at the federal level, and we haven't seen this sort of accountability at the federal level that we probably need to see at the FDA, at the CDC, and at other agencies. President Trump's announcement that he's going to withdraw from the World Health Organization could be a step toward some accountability with the WHO. I think the WHO has had a tremendous success, saved millions of lives by eradicating smallpox and combating other diseases. It could have done better, however, during COVID-19. And my hope is that President Trump's announcement that the United States will withdraw from the WHO is actually a gambit to try to get some leverage over how the World Health Organization conducts itself so that it could be a more effective tool for combating dangerous diseases.
Well, let's listen to the language he used when he made that announcement. And you can see in it that he does perhaps leave himself a bit of wiggle room. He makes it all about the money. Listen.
They wanted us back so badly, so we'll see what happens. Pretty sad, though. Think of it. China pays $39 million, and we pay $500 million. And China's a bigger country.
Fraser Jackson, you heard that we'll see what happens there in the remarks by Trump. Just how is this being interpreted? First of all, can Donald Trump walk away from can the United States just walk away from the WHO with a stroke of a pen? How does it work?
Technically, it is within Donald Trump's remit to be able to do this, but I think it's important to actually fact check that, as it is with many things that Donald Trump says. If you look at the money that the United States has given to the World Health Organization over the course of 2022 and 2023, for example, they gave $1.28 billion, a significant jump on the second largest donor, which was Germany, who gave $856 million. But the key thing to note here is that the vast majority of the money that the United States gives to the WHO is actually on a voluntary basis. It is not money which the WHO demands of the United States. In fact, there are membership dues, as it were, to be in the WHO, but they are a fraction of GDP. And if the US were to pay what it is owed as its membership dues, it would be about $130 million, significantly more somewhat than China's $88 million. But the rest of that money that the United States is giving is on a voluntary basis and is part of a global health spend. Now, of course, a lot of this money is going to the WHO, but it's not just going on COVID response. It's on a whole host of programs, as we've touched on, about the smallpox eradication. Well, the same thing is happening with polio, health emergency preparedness and pandemic preparedness. They have a whole host of issues that this money is impacting. So the United States withdrawal could have a significant impact on that planning and how the WHO works. But it's going to be interesting to see now whether other countries step forward to kind of take the slack for that or not. It's kind of hard to imagine that the Europeans, for example, will step into that void, but we could be seeing it coming from elsewhere. So Donald Trump, well within his rights to do so, and of course he's using that monetary, that fiscal argument as his backing for why he's pulling out of this.
All right. Just this week, by the way, Tanzania's president, Samia Suluhu Hassan, inviting the director general of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, to raise awareness over the outbreak of Marburg disease. That's in the Kagera region of Tanzania, near the borders with Uganda and Rwanda. 9 killed from that Ebola-like virus in this latest outbreak. And she praised the role played by the WHO. Moga Kamalyani, how important is the World Health Organization for much of the planet?
I'll tell you how you imagine the role of WHO. You want to build a lovely building here, with roof garden, with beautiful windows, with beautiful rooms, with everything comfortable and beautiful. People will see that. What people will not see is the basis, that the foundation of the building that you put under the ground. people don't see the clinical guidelines, how to deal with health systems, how to deal with disease X or disease Y. And that's not to mention outbreaks and infectious diseases, but also non-communicable diseases, rare diseases, what's so-called neglected diseases. So it's about diseases, how to promote health. I mean, WHO is about prevention, responding or treatment, and promotion and care for people who fall ill. But it's about promoting health, not just dealing with illness. All that is the foundation of global health that people don't seem to see. And therefore, the role of WHO is very, very essential to everybody, including the U.S. And the U.S. Agencies, health agencies, they work collaboratively with WHO. There's good collaboration between the two for the health of Americans and the health of the globe. And you mentioned Marburg disease in Tanzania, but WHO is deeply involved with the African Union, Africa CDC, in DRC, in Democratic Republic of Congo, with Mpox, with Rwanda, with Nigeria, with all the countries in Central and Eastern Africa who have who are suffering from monkeypox or Mpox, and trying to prevent the spread of this disease so it doesn't hit everybody else, including people in the north. I mean, this is the thing about viruses and microbes in general. They don't respect borders. So you can't have, you know, you have avian flu in the U.S. You can't control it on your own and say, we don't want to, we're not going to share the information with anybody else. You can't, because it will spread everywhere, and therefore it will come back to you, even if you control it in your country. So I think don't forget that when the UN was established in 1945, they established the World Health Organization as the legitimate global authority on health policy and health technical health agency, and everybody, it's not. The WHO is not Dr. Tedros or the Secretariat in Geneva or even the regional offices or country offices. WHO, the 196, I think now, member states that make decisions, including the U.S. The U.S. has a huge influence. And it's not China, it's the U.S. And one thing, when they established it, one thing all member states agreed on, that you can't, WHO Secretariat cannot just go to any country and say, right, you know, let me check how these things are happening in your country. The country has to invite them. If a country says, I don't have cholera, WHO can't say, no, you do have cholera, let me go and check. They can't do that. It's not in their authority. They don't have the authority to do that. So if you want to blame WHO for not going and checking on China, well, they couldn't. They just can't. They tried diplomatically and it didn't work. Does it mean that WHO did everything well and fine during COVID? No, they didn't. Of course not. There was a new disease. People didn't know what it was or how to combat it, how to prevent it. So as the learning was happening every day, WHO responded every day according to what the science was saying at the time. So of course they made mistakes, there's no doubt. But they tried. It wasn't intentional. It wasn't listening to a particular country and ignoring another country. It was actually the countries, and particularly our countries on the north, well, not all of them, some countries on the north, who didn't listen to the advice. They didn't listen to the warning of WHO saying, this is a serious disease, take measures. And they ignored it. And as colleague says a little earlier, that once it spread and became really a big problem, then they had to do a lockdown. Now, if they listened from the beginning, maybe we didn't have to have a lockdown. Maybe they could have taken some public health measures to prevent it. So WHO role is absolutely essential in pandemic, in outbreaks, in normal health issues, in dealing with diseases and with healthcare, in conflict and disaster, humanitarian situation.
Yeah. Throughout the world. Charlotte Marchandise, 5 years after that first lockdown in Wuhan, Air travel is back with a vengeance. Humans are going around the globe more than ever before. With globalization comes a higher risk of the spread of infectious diseases. All this right now, this opening day controversy with Donald Trump, is this just a storm in a teacup that will pass? That humanity has no alternative but to cooperate when it comes to global health policy, particularly in tackling pandemics?
Yeah, we do have to cooperate. And the withdrawal raises critical questions about the future of global health, the governance and international cooperation. But it's also, it raises governance about questions about how we little know about WHO. I mean, the previous colleague said a lot about it, but do we know, do people know that WHO is 8,000 people working there? So it's like, it's a small hospital in the US. It's a small city organization, well, mid-city administration. So it's a very small organization that has huge things to do. What we are feeling is that we would amplify all together, all the public health people, the voice of WHO. And especially in the North, we had mechanism. When the WHO says something, we have mechanism in the ministries to develop them and to disseminate and do something. And we didn't do it. And all the Ministry of Health in Europe, they were trained. They were training the 6 months before the pandemic came, so how to react to an emergency. The training was not enough. And what we are failing is what WHO is promoting is public health, all the prevention, all the health prevention. How do we train people? And for instance, when they have the floods in Valencia, you could see people having bad habits for health when they were risking their life to fight the floods. And the responses were kind of the same for that for the COVID, like putting a mask and being careful on all these things. So what I think is that now Europe, we have a huge opportunity to step into leadership role, to promote multilateralism, ensure that health crises are addressed collectively and that we put resilience, climate health, antimicrobial resistance, agriculture into this public health approach. And then, of course, we need mechanism for funding, for representation, to have more people, to include low and middle income countries in decision making. Because, yes, US had a big, big, still has a say when it comes to WHO. How do we make changes so that we organize bottom-up transnational responses to global health, to more education, and to integrate security into health? And sometimes we kind of have two speeches and they feel like really in silo. So let's use this opportunity and these dramatic things that is happening with the US leaving WHO to claim a little bit more, what is WHO and how could we make it ours? It's not something aside from us. It's the governance of WHO is the governance of the member states. So we need to make member states also accountable for how they use and how they work with WHO and therefore citizens.
And there's still a big role played by the United States in global health. Michael Cannon, we have a lot of viewers in West Africa who all remember how when there was a big Ebola outbreak there, it was when a case went to the United States that the U.S. sent in Army Corps of Engineers, and it was a real turning point in containing the disease. Those kinds of actions in the future, are they over under a Trump presidency?
So to correct the record, first of all, it's not clear that President Trump has the authority to withdraw the United States from the World Health Organization unilaterally. There are legal scholars like Larry Gostin at Georgetown University who say he has to go through Congress. Federal law says that the president shall appoint delegates to the World Health Organization, and that doesn't seem to give him any wiggle room there. But the president himself has said that the United States might pursue other organizations that could do the work that the World Health Organization is doing. It doesn't mean that he's going to retreat totally from global public health. And there could be other interventions that the United States government undertakes, like the ones that you mentioned. It doesn't... we haven't seen any evidence that the Trump administration is doing anything to try to replicate or replace the activities that it is seeking to defund at the World Health Organization. But some of the but some of that might be good.
Well, in that particular case, Michael, in that particular case, the Center for Disease Control, which is a U.S. organization, played a critical role in helping locate where the problem was when it came to that Ebola outbreak.
Here's one mistake that the World Health Organization is continuing to make right now, and so is the CDC and other public health agencies in the United States, that it could correct very easily. Stop giving people advice on private health matters. Stick to your knitting, which is public health. The World Health Organization is educating, some would say lecturing people about the health harms of alcohol. That's very important. I care very deeply about that issue. But when the World Health Organization or the Surgeon General of the United States or the United States Centers for Disease Control engage in research and advocacy about private health matters that only affect the person who's smoking or drinking, or criminal justice matters like firearms ownership.
Yeah, but Michael, smoking and drinking, it becomes a public health matter. Here in France, it becomes a public health matter because it's a drain on our public health service if then you have to go to the public hospital and treat these people.
That is not the case. That is not what public health is. Public health is when my behaviors affect someone else inadvertently without their consent, without any intervening decision. There are lots of the situations you described do not fit the definition of public health. And that is precisely because those things are controversial. Those other issues are controversial that people try to sneak them in under the rubric of public health. So and makes these things make people distrust public health agencies. So if you really want to control the spread of dangerous, contagious diseases, you need to get the World Health Organization, the Centers for Disease Control, and all public health agencies to leave that to the private sector, leave that to other people to worry about, and focus only on public health legitimate public health issues like the spread of deadly contagious diseases, because that is how you build trust. That is how you get people to listen to what you the very important messages you have for them on vaccination and other issues.
Mogul Kamalyani, you agree that it's not the remit of public health authorities to tell private citizens how to lead their lives?
I totally disagree. Smoking and alcohol are real public health issues. Smoking includes secondary smoking. Smokers get money from the family for their habit, and same with alcohol, of course, and that's at the expense of food for children. The alcohol is very, very much attached, close to, or is related to violence against women, violence against children, problems in the street. There's lots of effects. It's not the effect of them is not a public health in terms of they produce germs or a virus. No, but it's public health in terms of violence against women and children. Is that not a public health issue? It's not a public health issue when women or children are beaten up, when children are pulled from school, when rape happens, when sexual harassment happens because of alcohol. I mean, come on. What is public health then? I think we have a problem defining what public health is. And in any way, health is not just about just infections. It's about promoting health. So promoting healthy habits, promoting healthy diet, healthy physical activities, mental health, all that promoting health, is public health as well. It's about combating, so prevention and treatment and care of chronic diseases that are not caused by infection, so like diabetes and, you know, heart diseases, blood pressure, all these things. Health is a big thing. Health is like, and look at the definition of health and healthcare. It's a big definition, and therefore these are definitely public health. If you don't consider that violence against women as a public health issue, we're not on the same page at all. And the fact
all right,
that
so two different points of views. We're running short on time, and before we go, I just wanted to ask Fraser Jackson, Washington. Up until Wednesday, we did not yet have a confirmation hearing date for Robert F. Kennedy Jr. who is Donald Trump's nominee for health secretary. We have one now. He's even been working to sanitize his image, resigning from his anti-vax nonprofit. If he's confirmed, he's promised to stop collecting fees on some of his vaccine lawsuits involving the U.S. government. How do his chances of getting confirmed stand at this point?
Well, I think he's one of the most contentious nominees that have been put forward to the Senate. There are certain others. Obviously, Marco Rubio got very easily confirmed in the Senate and is now in the role. I think really a lot of Democrats and even potentially a couple of Republicans are picking their battles here and are willing to die on certain hills or are willing to let certain things slide. So I think The two real people that people will be looking most closely at are, of course, the DOD nomination, Pete Hegseth. There's been another a revelation about him in the last 24 or so hours. And RFK is going to be somebody that people are looking closely at as well. So the other thing that you have to really look at is the majority that the Republicans have. It's obviously they have control of both chambers of Congress, but it is a very, very small, margin, and it only takes a few to cross sides for them to block a nomination. So RFK is one of the more controversial nominees, and the Democrats, I'm sure, will be definitely putting up a fight to try to make sure that he doesn't get into that role.
Very briefly, Fraser, because we're out of time, just in a sentence or two. You covered the campaign for us. COVID was not a big campaign issue. Thinking back on it, and when you have this controversy around Trump's nominee for health secretary, would you call it a silent issue, perhaps?
I think, honestly, it's something that people have tried their hardest to forget about. So it doesn't feel like something that people really are voting on, but the ramifications of the COVID policy over the course of the last 4 years are potentially impacting people's decision-making processes.
Fraser Jackson in Washington, I want to thank you. I want to thank as well Michael Cannon for being with us from the U.S. Capitol. Moga Kamal Yani in Oxford. I also want to thank Charlotte Marchandise for joining our conversation. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.